Hello, you're listening to On the Point, the News Collective's show formerly known as Democracy Watch, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affair coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Isa Yu.
I'm Akshay Kulkarni.
I'm Lauren Benson.
I'm Josh Azizi.
I'm Zachary Tharp. It's Thursday, February 27th at 5:07 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC Vancouver's campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
We've got a packed show for you this evening. We look back to the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Woman Memorial March from 2 weeks ago. We've also got a piece about food justice, and we are also having a discussion about fraternities in the AMS in light of recent reporting by me for the UBC. But first, it's time for local headlines.
Okay, so 2019 saw a decrease in overdose-related deaths in Vancouver. According to the provincial government's coroner's service, drug toxicity was down 36% in comparison to 2018, with 981 deaths in 2019 and 1,543 deaths in 2018. Though this may seem like an improvement, the report notes that this is still drastically higher than the 529 deaths in 2015, a year before it was declared a public health crisis. The cities that had the most drug toxicity deaths in 2019 were Vancouver, Surrey, Victoria, and Abbotsford. 76% of the victims were male, who averaged at 30 to 50 years old, though fatalities ranged from people 13 to 76 years old. Provincial Health Officer Dr. Bonnie Henry says that the decrease in deaths proved that harm reduction measures are helping, but that BC is still far from out of the woods with this crisis.
Yep, thank you for that. And we're going to take a quick ad break, but then we'll have some great stories for you afterwards. So keep listening to CITR.
Have you ever thought about going abroad to study, work, volunteer, or learn a new language? Mark Tuesday, March 3rd in your calendar and get down to the Vancouver Convention Center East Building to find out how. All the experts under one roof, top universities, gap year specialists, and student travel organizations. Feature seminar starts at 1 p.m. and expo opens at 2 p.m. Admission is free. Check online at www.studyandgoabroad.com for more info.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Feeling lost in the lonely, meaningless cyberweb? Looking to connect with other users? Then plug in to a CITR collective. Meet users who are compatible with your interests and passions. CITR's mainframe offers 9 unique collectives: news, arts, accessibility, sports, persons of color, indigenous, gender empowerment, LGBTQ2SIA+, and music affairs. CITR collectives are where you can make great radio, great friends, and avoid the abject loneliness of life in the cyber void.
So, for our first piece this evening, we have a feature by Akshay Kulkarni recapping the Women's Memorial March that occurred on February 14th.
Cool. Yeah, thanks, Isa. So, I'll try to break down the meaning behind the march that happened 2 weeks ago, and what the piece you're going to hear soon is about. So, it's the 28th annual Women's Memorial March, started in 1992. You might be wondering, well, why do we need to remember women? Well, it's not really in a traditional sense. So let me try to explain. So for those who aren't aware, the phenomenon of missing and murdered Indigenous women, it's a huge, almost like epidemic in Canada. It's been going on for years and years and years. I mean, needless to say. And it's like almost a systematic failing of Indigenous women and girls. It's like people are saying it should be called a genocide. I tend to agree, but you know, that's a debate for later day. The rate of homicide for Indigenous females was almost 7 times higher than other women in Canada. That's according to a 2011 report, and it's almost almost surely gotten worse since then. And there was a report, which an inquiry that concluded last year, and one of the main significant findings was that deaths of Indigenous women were simply treated differently compared to other crimes and murders. Like, they just weren't given the time of day. And so systematic failings which led to this almost epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women. And as we all know, downtown Eastside in Vancouver, it's an area with a lot of social problems, and it's no surprise that a lot of urban Indigenous women have been killed or been, you know, gone missing or been assaulted in that area. So 28 years ago, there was a murder of Cheryl Anjo. She was a mother of three. She was also a sex worker and brutally murdered. And since then, every year on Valentine's Day, where everyone else is supposedly celebrating love or whatever, their families are gathered in the downtown east side to honor the women that they've lost. So they play drums, they burn medicine, and they sing songs while marching throughout. And as you listen to the piece, the audio that you hear underneath most of it is the Women Warrior Song by the Lower Mainland Indigenous peoples. And that is supposed to give strength to the women, and that's supposed to, you know, honor their lives. So the feature you will hear now is an attempt for me to convey how it felt to be a settler at this march, almost looking in, and, you know, how my Valentine's Day ended up being, it usually is very different anyway, but it ended up being quite different. So yeah, listening to the Women's Memorial March from 2 weeks ago. February 14th is supposed to be our one mandated day for examining our relationships. But it means so much more than candy hearts and balloons over on the downtown east side. This February 14th was the 28th annual Women's Memorial March. This annual act of remembrance was first started in 1992. It was a response to the death of Coast Salish women Cheryl Ann Joe on Powell Street. Cheryl had hoped to become a police officer to help the vulnerable, but she was brutally murdered by Brian Allender, and her death caused widespread grief in her community and beyond. Since then, families and supporters of missing and murdered Indigenous women wear red and walk to the downtown east side to honor their lost loved ones every Valentine's Day.
Three steps to make a lane between this doorway entrance here to the street. The families are preparing to come out.
As far as you can go that way.
Either side. This side or that side.
Just this way, right here. Just turn around this way. So that we're welcoming them.
Okay.
The march begins at Hastings and Main with speeches and rituals, including medicine burning and drumming. At first, progress was slow, but we soon found out why.
The march is now along a side street. It's not along the main roads anymore, and I've been told that we're stopping at places where Indigenous women were either last seen or when they were killed, to sort of, you know, write the medicine and you know, commemorate them. It's a slow-moving march, but quite a few people here.
The grief in the air is palpable, and this year's march has simmering undertones of tension. The recent RCMP action against the Wet'suwet'en people is highlighted in a number of signs, such as Wet'suwet'en Strong and Sovereignty Was Never Ceded, No to Man Camps. Speakers, such as Reuben George from the Tsleil-Waututh Nation, also bring up the RCMP's crackdown, and they underscore the anger that these communities have felt and are feeling. Here's another speaker towards the end.
I hope more of you will find your voice. You know, we are pushed to do this. We are, because we keep telling you, you're in trouble, our planet's in trouble, but nothing will stop you until we, your money, the root of all evil, is affected. Sorry about that. But now you know a little bit what it's like living on a war camp, a reservation that BC paid zero for. We did not cede this land. And I'm saying, I'm sorry I'm getting too far away, but hey, hey, ho, ho, man camps have got to go. Hey, hey, ho, ho, man camps have got to go. Hey, hey, ho, ho, man camps have got to go.
The music you're hearing is up-tempo and fast-paced. An hour into the march, it has started to slow down. It dawns on me that deep-rooted remorse is being expressed through this music. A remorse and pain that many Canadian settlers will never ever have to experience. Musqueam activist Audrey Siegel knows this pain intimately. She tells me what this march means to her.
Everybody here has lost at least one person. Like, we're here to honor our murdered, missing, our loved ones, our women that only walk with us in spirit now.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, you kind of underscored how big this occasion is. Like, how much does it mean to the community here in the Lower Mainland, really?
To be able to gather, to gather together every year to honor our loved ones, for people to put aside what goes on in their everyday lives and to be here to not just heal together, but not just mourn together, but to heal together. That's a huge part of how we move forward.
Well, you mentioned moving forward. I mean, there's been a lot of recent sort of, you know, tension around this. As a settler, really, it feels almost weird coming here. Like, I don't really know how to describe it. So, like, what would you say moving forward even looks like?
Why does it feel weird? I'm curious.
Because I
want to know.
Well, I don't know. I don't feel like I'm intruding per se, but I do feel like I'm at a place where the focus isn't on me to come forward in the protest, you know what I mean?
So as support and as a witness, we have important roles for people to witness ceremonies, to witness work, because we didn't have lawyers, we didn't have affidavits, we didn't have legal contacts. What we had were witnesses who were called on, that if there was a question about how a work or an event happened, witnesses were called to share their experience. So you're here as an important role as a witness, and you have tools to do that witnessing work with. And this is like a huge point for me, that I don't agree with neutral media. Neutrality takes the side of the oppressor, like everybody knows the quote. So we need media to step up and have an opinion, take a side, represent the truth of what's going on, not just the dollar-based bottom lines.
Exactly.
Because if we did that, we wouldn't be marching for more and more women each year. Every year. How many years is this 23rd, 27th, 28th year for this march? And every year we're marching and honoring more women. And so we need to look at the underlying roots of why is that? How is that happening?
The last point Audrey makes about the media strikes me. Missing and murdered Indigenous women is the result of systemic ignorance and the silencing of Indigenous voices. This silencing is illustrated with red handprints painted over the mouths of many marchers. I noticed a young woman applying these red handprints on others, and I was curious to find out what it meant.
I was curious, why are you putting the red paint on your hands?
The red paint, it's like we're putting it on our mouths for the ones that don't have a mouth anymore, a voice.
Oh.
Yeah, so for everyone that's missing and murdered, in Indigenous, that don't no longer have a voice.
As a journalist, I leave the march thinking about how the media has let Indigenous people down. I think about the practical difficulties newsrooms face. How can you condense the stories of so many when you're on deadline? How can you express so many emotions in so little time? I don't know the answer to that question. But as Audrey says, sometimes our role may just be to witness. The voiceless may have been silenced, but that doesn't mean they never had a voice. Giving the platform to those voices is something I know we can do better in the media. Curtis Ahenikew is a Cree man from Attakoop First Nation in Saskatchewan and a cultural worker at the Aboriginal Friendship Society in downtown Vancouver. He tells me his perspective on media coverage of Indigenous issues.
talked to someone before about why this day means so much. But in, why does it mean so much to you personally?
Well, I work at the Friendship Center, and part of my job is to work with the homeless. And of course, I hear stories about the missing and murdered sisters. We've had events at the Friendship Center to honor people that work in and around with the sisters. And myself personally, I've known sisters that have gone missing and family members. So I've been here, I've been coming to this thing just about every year. And sometimes I'll bring medicine to smudge the people. It burned it all up when we first started to help the feeling, the good feelings that are happening here. And I think when we come collectively and participate, it sends a vibe. Metaphysical, supernatural, I don't know what the word we could use, but I think when you bring that medicine out and you drum, I think it adds and it lifts us up. So I think that lifts the kind of a dark veil of the injustice. I'm very passionate about being here, and I think that maybe we're a little closer to that unveiling the darkness of government and officials that have just said, don't say anything, because if you say something, you're going down, you're all the way up the ladder. All the way up the ladder, right to Ottawa. Someone knows something, and it trickles down. So it's not an easy topic to talk about, you know. It's a point fingers about who's guilty and who's not. But I think the legitimacy of knowing some facts, some hardcore facts about what happened. And I grew up in Saskatoon, and in Saskatoon, I experienced stuff about loss of brothers. Lawrence Wagner from the Starlight Tours, where police would drop off people outside the city. That was my friend. So yeah, it's a little personal about the injustices. But we're all trying our best to work together, like you guys being here and documenting that and getting that out there the most kindest way. Most kindest way. You know, and media, you know about media, radio and television. You gotta get brave and don't be scared to say, hey, this is what we heard.
Talking to people at the march reminds me that justice won't happen overnight. But until it does, the Women's Memorial March and its complicated expression of grief and upliftment will continue to be an annual fixture in the downtown east side. It's a Valentine's Day reminder that for many people, celebrating loved ones also means fighting for them. Thank you for listening. Reporting and production was done by me, Akshay Kulkarni.
You're listening to On The Point on CITR 101.9 FM. That was Akshay Kulkarni, and So let's talk about food, pivoting in a completely different direction. I didn't prep for this, but just so you know, I'm really interested in food, not just from like a individual's like consumption point of view, but also from like examining the role food plays in our lives and in our society and how agricultural systems, and that includes like production and distribution, reflects that. So I have an interview I conducted with Joyce Liao and Marin Corkery, two students at UBC. So let's take a listen. Yeah, do you mind introducing yourselves?
I'm Joyce. I'm a fifth year student in the Faculty of Land and Food Systems in the Global Resource Systems program.
And I'm Marin. I'm also a fifth-year student in Global Resource Systems in the Faculty of Land and Food Systems. And we're working together on a Teaching and Learning Enhancement Fund project called Just Food.
So can you tell me a bit more? I know that you guys did a seminar on like food equity. Can you expand on that? Can you describe what is food equity?
The course itself was around the topic of food justice. And so it was a student-directed seminar co-facilitated by Marin and I around that topic.
Do you mind explaining what food justice is?
It's a big question, but I think there's a lot of different terms that you can talk about food, like food security, food sovereignty, all those different kind of jargony things. But what we kind of talked about in our seminar and focused on was the idea of food justice that's looking at some of these bigger systems that affect our food systems and the power structures within that. So looking at, like, very broadly neoliberalism and patriarchy and how those kind of bigger systems can impact access to food and impact these other food problems that we talk about in our courses or that we hear about in the news and that kind of thing. So kind of really taking that broader look at things, but then also looking at how there's different dynamics, like racial dynamics, gender dynamics, all of these other things that impact our food system.
And so can you, like, give me an example? Like, I know this is, we don't have the time for, like, a whole course, but do you mind explaining, like, for example, how does the patriarchy affect food distribution and stuff like that?
Maybe an example with gender is probably the most accessible one might be in terms of labor, just, like, division of labor in the household, division of labor for work generally, like, who is working as top chefs and who is working behind the counter at Tim Hortons, you know. I think there's very gender dynamics to that. Also, like, class dimensions and race. There's intersectionalities to all of that.
So how did you guys get involved in this? Like, what is your relationship to food?
Oof. I feel like that's a big question. But I think, like, we both started off our degree in, I think, very different places than we ended up right now. But I think for me it was kind of that recognizing that there are these bigger structures that I knew very little about. So for me, I started my degree interested in nutrition and was like, oh, I just want people to eat better. And I didn't realize that in itself is kind of a problematic idea, in that there's this one idea of what better is and what good food is. And I think that doing this, getting more involved in this project, has made me realize that there are these different dimensions to how to have good food or whatever good food is, and there isn't one. So I think for me that's kind of been a changing thing of realizing that there's so little that I know about the food system and just how there are these different things that affect it. So I think my relationship has changed a lot now. I'm more interested in these broader ideas instead of just nutrition, and that because there are so many different, exciting, interesting aspects to this problem.
I guess similar to Marin, I feel like I started in a very different place. I feel like I came to university like wanting to become a farmer. I feel like I watched a lot of documentaries about how messed up our food system is and was like, oh, I'm going to change the world by, like, farming in, like, organic permaculture kind of way. So I think that was kind of my mentality coming in, and I did a lot of gardening in my first couple of years at UBC and growing food and seeing what that looked like, and then just realizing that I didn't really want to become a farmer. It's a lot of hard work.
It's so hard.
Yeah, props to all the farmers out there. But realizing that there's so much nuance within agriculture, and then I think I did a lot of, like, exploration into, like, identity, specifically, like, ethnic and racial identity during my second and third and then into fourth year, and then realizing, oh, I really want to be able to work within my communities around food systems and what does that look like. And I feel like food justice has been a really interesting way to explore that.
And so, like, in our culture, there's a lot of, like, the idea of, like, food just being for sustenance, or, like there's a lot of emphasis on calories or just, like, numbers and stuff like that. But I know there are, like, different ways in which food can be important, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. I'm not really wording it very well. But in what other ways can food, what other values does food have, like other than just sustenance, is what I'm trying to say.
Maybe linking it back to the topic of food justice and what that means. One of the like more academic definitions of food justice gets to look at it in four different ways. And one of them is like equity / trauma. So that looks at broader systems that we've briefly touched on before, like patriarchy and capitalism and these underlying systems that our society has been built upon, and we're living in those legacies and are therefore complicit. Labor, yeah, so who's doing the work and whose work is valued and compensated, and what does fair work look like, and I mean, that intersects with things like we previously talked about, like gender, like who gets, like is there a wage gap between men and women or people of color and other folks. There's also the issue of land, which I think is really interesting because we have to grow food on land, or the like spatial components of that and what that looks like. I think particularly in our context, that understanding that the land that we're on is traditional unceded territory of the Musqueam people is like incredibly important to highlight, and being like, what are the implications for that in our food system and how we operate in our daily lives? What does it mean to have access to food, but more so access to food that is culturally relevant, that belongs to your community, that you've been eating for since time memorial? Like, what does that mean within like the conventional food system that we, most of us, operate in?
I think like getting back to your initial question of like, what are these other ways, like values of food? And I think that's kind of what has attracted me to learning about these concepts, is because food can be this incredible community builder in this way that people connect and everything, and is a really interesting way to explore these kind of really big challenging structures. And when we're dealing with these kind of historical legacies that are still present today, it's like food can be this connector, because yeah, everyone has to eat for calories and sustenance, but it's more than that. It does have that kind of cultural connection and that that foundation that we can then have these kind of tougher conversations and start to kind of tackle these bigger problems too.
Well, what do you guys think about how the fact that nowadays when we are very disconnected from our food sources, we a lot of times like we don't really know where our food is coming from, where it's being grown, who's doing that labor? Like, how do you feel about that? Like, your opinions, I guess.
I mean, I think in some ways it is problematic, but at the same time recognizing that it's what we've inherited, and so it's not per se that we all need to like go back to like agrarian ways and isolate ourselves and run our own little farms and things like that, but finding the ways in which we can contribute. And I feel like the problem, the way that it's shown in like media oftentimes, is like a very like individualized way of combating that, and like being like, oh, we're so out of touch with nature and with our food, so we have to like seek these ways to like get in touch, which often means like voting with your fork and like using kind of a consumer mentality to mm-hmm. like get back in touch with nature, or get back in touch with our food through like buying organically or buying locally through like farmers markets. Which I think is problematic in that it's so individualized, and it takes away from the fact that these are systemic problems that are very much, their structures way beyond the individual. And so the solutions that we should be looking at, while individualized might be important, being able to do something in a larger group, I think has longer term impacts.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. But I think like there's there's definitely still value to like going to a farmer's market and meeting farmers and that kind of thing. Like, I think in our faculty especially, like, we kind of forget that so few people know anything about these systems. So I think for us, we're trying to think of like these bigger things that can kind of push the needle towards a more sustainable food system, but also acknowledging that some people just don't even think about where their food comes from. So if something is going to get the average person to start thinking about that, I think that's still good and has value in itself. But then for the people who are starting to be more aware of these issues, it's finding ways to kind of like take that energy and take that interest and transform it into more effective change on a globe, like on a larger scale, and not just buying like one organic apple a week. Like that's great, but it's not enough. Like, we need to find these ways that can kind of take that and turn it into something more impactful.
So for someone who's interested in getting involved in accessing more knowledge on this, like, what are some practical steps that people who aren't, say, in the LFS faculty, like, what can they do?
I think what's amazing about UBC right now is that there's a lot of student initiatives already going on. Roots on the Roof is a student-run garden and club located on the fourth floor of the Nest, and they do lots of interesting workshops and teaching people how to garden. So that's like a very tangible way of, like, you know, using your hands and getting involved that way.
And there's also UBC Sprouts, which I've been involved with, which is a cafe on campus that's all volunteer run and trying to source locally grown food and kind of navigating those issues of what is local food and how can we actually support these food systems. And there's also a lot of groups that are doing work that impacts the food system. So like UBC C350 and the Social Justice student. What is so UBC Social Justice? That one. I can't remember the exact name. But like, those are people working towards these larger issues that have tangible impacts on our food system. So even getting involved with those might not be directly food issues, but it, like, as we like to say, it's all connected. It's all a system. So those are really good groups to get involved with. And the UBC Farm is also an awesome resource and has volunteer and job opportunities and that kind of thing for students to start learning about these broader issues as well.
Going back to the idea of like food justice, can you give me a bit more of like background and history on food justice?
So I think food justice, it's interesting because it's like, it's a very North American term. Like, there's these more global movements that are kind of food sovereignty, like peasant-led movements, like La Via Campesina, that kind of thing. So food justice is kind of unique in a North American context in that there's academia starting to talk about it, but I think it's kind of risen out of those food sovereignty talks and food security talks that maybe they realized that there was something missing from those. And I think food justice is distinct from those in that it looks at the food system as a racial project and all of like these bigger systems. So I think like in the last maybe 20 years, there's been a lot more academic discourse on it, but there's always been groups working towards this kind of change. It's just now we have this fancy word for it that we're trying to say and like trying to define what justice is and how do we have a just food system. So I think it's been interesting kind of diving into this in the last couple of years because there isn't like a consensus on what food justice is. And there's lots of groups who are probably doing food justice but not calling it that. And then there's other groups that are using the term food justice and they're maybe not doing that because they're still working within these systems. So it's kind of hard when you're looking at the term food justice because it is kind of working towards this unknown, this idea of what the food system could look like that is just and is fair and does give people the access to food and the power over their food system that we don't currently have. So in that sense, it's kind of constantly changing term and something that will be constantly changing and evolving. So that doesn't really answer your question, but...
No, I think it's good. That's all the questions I have for this. If I have any follow-up questions, like, I'll check in with you guys. Thank you guys so much for sitting down with me. This was really fun.
Hey, are you interested in radio? Passionate about gender issues? Want to be an active part of your community? Then join the wave and become part of CITR's Gender Empowerment Collective. We meet every Friday at 2 p.m. and we want your voice. We are all about empowering everyone and giving you the chance to speak your mind. No experience necessary. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, or email us at genderempowerment@citr.ca.
Accessibility.
Disability.
Mental health.
ADHD and ADD.
And many, many more topics we explore and cover.
But where?
On CITR's All Access Pass.
A unique and collectively run show on equity, inclusion, and creating awareness for people of all abilities in BC and around the world.
Catch us every other Wednesday afternoon from 3 to 4.
If you want more info or want to get involved, please find us on Facebook or send us an email at accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
Now the patriarchy is dead, and we killed it. If you identify as a woman, femme, trans, or non-binary, CITR wants you on the air. You can talk about literally whatever you want as long as you care about it. No worries if you have no experience, we'll train you in everything you need to know. Come by CITR and say hi.
Hey. Hi. Hello.
From 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday to Friday to help us never play Led Zeppelin on CITR 101.9 FM ever again. I could be you. And we are back. Thanks for listening. Right now, you're hearing On the Point by the News Collective at CITR 101.9 FM.
Lastly, Zach has a recap and a headline on the fraternity situation here at UBC.
Thanks, Lauren. So, yes, long ago in my younger years, I covered a controversial event on campus that involved an economics professor named Marina Adshade tweeting about multiple women being basically drugged at a fraternity party here at UBC. It was a pretty fierce debate on campus over whether fraternities should be protected by the AMS or not. They basically eventually came and said the AMS is no longer backing the fraternities, and they basically, IFC, the Interfraternity Council, which oversees all the fraternities as a whole, is basically has cut ties with the AMS and the university, sort of. And now the fraternities have come out and say, like, we're not doing any open parties. There's only closed parties. But it still begs the question, who has oversight over the fraternities? Are they basically free reign now, or are they going to be held to a more responsible and strict, like, code of conduct?
Zach, I'm sorry. I have to fact check you on that one. The IFC and AMS are actually, like... Oh, sorry. Is it not good? Oh, yeah, okay. I kind of have to speak directly into the mic here. Yeah. No, the IFC and AMS, they haven't cut ties with one another. I don't know about the IFC's relationship with the university, but the IFC and AMS, like, are talking with one another a lot about, like, what the future between the two of them will look like. They've been kicked out of – they're no longer an AMS club. They've been deconstituted.
Okay, that's what I mean.
But they're, like, still talking about, like, how they'll, quote-unquote, work together and, like, develop a relationship in a way where, as they say, that the AMS can hold them accountable if, like, something they don't like – if something that they don't like is going on. So for something like that. So they are in communication with one another.
So, like, they're in communication, but they, like – so IFC isn't – and AMS clubs, they don't have the same AMS benefits that other clubs have, I guess?
They're working to develop, like, kind of, like, a agreement. I mean, the correct term is memorandum of understanding, but they're working to develop like, an agreement that kind of explains, like, if they can get certain privileges, like club space or the SASC training for the Sexual Assault Support Center.
Yeah, so obviously this is all based on reporting Josh himself has done this week. He got a shout out from Justin McElroy over at CBC News. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, riding that high still. So just tell us, Josh, like, obviously we just talked about what's been happening and we just talked about how parties are going to be closed now. What do you think that will just mean for, well, campus life and UBC in general? Like, just one opinion, basically.
That's actually... That's something that I've kind of thought of, but I haven't dwelled on too much in my head. So I think I'm going to try to make some guesses. I mean, fraternity parties are, they're really big within two groups. One, obviously, is the Greek village. Well, open fraternity parties. They're big within two groups, like the Greek community and first-year students. So it's a bit of a, they're big among, like, the younger crowd in first years. So them no longer being open to the entire public, I mean, it's kind of, I guess it's kind of an is something that's just going to be less common among them. But among the Greek community, it's like this is a, I'd say it's a big shift, but arguably a shift that might have been, like, it's a shift that would probably was coming, I would say, just given, I mean, the changing conversations surrounding, like, sexual assault and sexual violence, and especially in light of the allegations of Dr. Marina Adshade. So it's something that... you know, I looking back, I think it's something that was coming.
So obviously, the move now, which is like closed parties, no open invites, sort of raises the question of there might have been a sexual assault problem before, but now the responsibilities look so much different, right? Because mm-hmm. now the frats aren't. They only have a memorandum of understanding with the AMS. They're not a technical society anymore.
Well, they're developing one.
Yeah. And, like, you know, they're not subject to many rules. And now, since the parties are now closed off, the question of whether sexual assaults, people who might experience sexual assaults, touch wood, nothing happens, going forward, who's responsible now? Because now the parties are closed off. What does that mean?
I mean, predators are predators, to put it bluntly. If they can't go somewhere, they're going to go somewhere else. But they're definitely, like... Fraternity parties are just kind of, I mean, just speaking from my own experiences, like, you know, attending these parties in first year university, they're, to put it bluntly, like, very sexually charged areas with, like, you know, a lot of people hooking up. There's a lot of guys, you know, kind of, for lack of a better way to put it, like, making moves on younger women. And I was reading a Toronto Star article earlier just before the show that it was with some young students kind of recalling their experiences of fraternity parties and just immediately being hit on by a lot of older guys. And so, you know, it's kind of an area that, I mean, it's definitely, those parties are areas where this happens a lot, but, you know, this is obviously not, it's not like this is going to change a lot of things, I think, in the long run. And I mean, fraternities are still having parties. Like, they're just no longer open to the complete public. It's a invite-based system.
So, yeah, I mean, I was just curious what everyone else was thinking. So we just talked about the culture of responsibility, you know, who's going to be responsible now? Like, will this change the culture at frats? So let me just open it up. So, like, what do you guys think? Do you think it will change the culture at frats at all?
Well, I don't want to be too accusatory, so take whatever I say with a grain of salt. But I think it's important to consider that sexual assault can be... enacted by people outside, like outside of the Greek life system as well as inside. And so we do also have to consider, even with closed parties, how are the frats going to be held responsible if something happens? Yeah, Zachary, you were in a frat. Want to jump on in?
Zach was in a frat?
He was.
Yes, as like the resident frat expert, I guess.
I know, disgusting.
I would say it's more of a cultural thing. I know the university means well and AMS, you know, means well, but I feel like without explicit oversight by the university, by a, let's say, I guess, professional or administrative representative that couldn't just, you know, put them on the chopping block and really hold them responsible, because I've had incidences when I was in a fraternity where we've had to go to, or it was called like the Office of Fraternity and Sorority Greek Life, whatever. And they basically had each and every one of us come in, talk about like, hey, you know, what happened at this time? What happened at this time?
and they'd want an honest opinion. And then at the end of it, they're like, okay, based on what you guys all told us and based on what we know, we are going to put you on such and such suspension, and you can't do this for X amount of days or X amount of months or even X amount of years, depending on how bad the situation is. And that really holds people accountable. It's like, okay, if the university is going to come down on us and say we can't do this, we can't have social events, or we can't, in some cases, even live in the house, then, you know, they're going to want to be more transparent. And if the university promotes that, if you're honest with us and you do everything that we ask of you and you don't break any rules, then, you know, we will be less harsh on you. But if you do break the rules, or if you do try to cover up something, we will, there is a very real possibility of us just revoking your charter. Like, you guys came here, I know, possibly, you know, multiple generations ago, many of your, you know, parents or grandparents weren't even alive when your fraternity received a charter from the university to exist on campus. But we still have the power to take away that charter. And you guys, I mean, there's no rule against having a bunch of guys hang out in a house that's off campus and party if that's what people want to do. But to be a recognized fraternity through the university, you have to follow these rules. And if you don't, then, you know, bye-bye.
You know, what's interesting, actually, is that the actual policy thing that the IFC got deconstituted for from the AMS, like, was that within the AMS kind of rule book for how a club can operate, you can't make it so that, you know, a club is only males.
Mm-hmm.
That is actually what got them kicked out.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was kind of the interesting thing about this. And they also determined that the UBC sororities is within violation of the same rule. Mm-hmm. So they're like kind of weighing, okay, what do we do now with the sororities? So
mm-hmm. I think the thing about frats is that it can often like turn into a toxic and like very masculine environment that isn't necessarily healthy or safe for a lot of people. And I can understand a lot of people's like distrust of the fraternities and how they might handle allegations of sexual assault. And we also have to understand that like it's very hard for victims to come forward. I do question if just having the workshops that they do have with SASC, is that enough? And how frats can actually be accountable? And also, are the quote-unquote higher-ups in the frats, are they willing to hold their own members responsible? Like, if something comes up, are they willing to do what's right, for lack of better words? That's my concern.
You know, I mean, I did interview the president of the IFC to talk about this. And it seemed like issues like such as sexual violence and I guess kind of the culture within fraternities, it seems like that he was expressing concern about all those things. And he takes the SASC training that the frat members get annually. He said that like he takes it seriously. So, I mean, obviously I am not in a frat. I have not stepped foot in the Greek village since my second year of university. So I don't have a lot of personal experience being within that culture, so I couldn't offer anything else. But at least in an interview to a journalist that was on the record, it seemed like they were making efforts to become more progressive on the issue.
Mm-hmm. I just like remembered this from my first term here. Mm-hmm. Actually, I remember going into a frat, and that was the first and only time I ever went to a frat. And seeing this girl who was very clearly drunk hooking up with this guy who was sober. Like, I never, like, just, like, talking about this is, like, giving me flashbacks. And I'm, like, realizing what an unsafe situation that mm-hmm. was. But at the time, like, I didn't really think about it as much. Like, I was like, oh, this girl's really drunk. But now looking back, I'm like, that shouldn't have been happening. Like, he should not have been hooking up with her. So I do think, like, now I could say I have witnessed these unsafe situations, and now I'm like, I do think frats are like a lot of times frat parties can become unsafe for women. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think the question of whether to reform frats and but how to change the cultures that, you know, go through it and whether it needs to be changed at all. I mean, that's an ongoing discussion that we will keep having for a while. But yeah, I think that just underscores Josh's amazing reporting this week. Go check out his article.
Thank you.
It's on the UBC. It got covered by Justin McElroy of CBC News. You know, he's just going all over the place. He's destined for big things. So yeah, that brings us to the end of our show. Thank you so much for listening. This has been On The Point by CITR News Collective. We're here every Thursday at 5 p.m. bringing you local undercover news. Stay tuned for more amazing programming from CITR. Up next is Heavy Content. They have great stuff. So yeah, keep it tuned to CITR 101.9 FM.